Before we get started with today's show, I want to tell you about another great ESPN podcast. The Mina Kimes Show featuring Lenny is a podcast that brings you the latest news and trends in and around the NFL. Join Mina and her guests such as NFL analyst Dominique Foxworth, insider and fantasy football focus host Field Yates, and ESPN Radio's Mike Golic Jr. If you like X's and O's, analytics, and probably too much dog talk, Lenny is a dog, then give The Mina Kimes Show featuring Lenny a listen wherever you get your podcast. Also, NBA Today, hosted by Malika Andrews, offers exclusive content Monday through Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific. Alongside Malika, there will be a full cast of NBA experts and insiders, including Kendrick Perkins, Chinee Agumake, Vince Carter, Zach Lowe, Adrian Wojnarowski, Ramona Shelburne, and many of our NBA reporters from around the league. Get caught up with the latest from around the NBA on NBA Today on ESPN and the ESPN app. One app, one tap. And also available as a podcast. Listen to NBA Today wherever you get your podcasts. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcasts. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars, I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. It is that time of week where we have a guest join us, coming to us live from not quite sunny, but it's still California. He was the host of Slow Burn Season 6 on the Los Angeles riots of 1992. And he think he was the fastest 10-year-old in America one time. Joel Anderson, what's going on?
I have a certificate and a medal that testifies to the fact that I was the fastest 10-year-old in 1988. And don't make me pull it out, because it's embarrassing when I do it. People should be able to accept it. Now, I didn't say I was the fastest 18-year-old in 1996. I said I was the fastest 10-year-old. So that you all should just believe that. But, you know, if I have to go to the point of bringing out the evidence, I will do that.
Now, I see. I feel like you won the contest, right? Like, I'm not saying that you didn't win the contest. I'm just saying that the title for winning the contest is the fastest 10-year-old in America. It doesn't necessarily mean you were the fastest 10-year-old in America, but you did win a contest.
They could have went to their Jesse Owens free, you know, 100-meter dash down the street from their, you know, from their school to do it. You know what I'm saying? There was nothing preventing them from showing up at the track the same as I did and doing what I did. It wasn't cost prohibitive. You know, if you were fast enough, the coaches would ask you to come and be on the team for free. Okay? So, but anyway, but I just wanted to real quick, because, you know, Bomani, you used to, you know, back in the day when you were in Miami, you know, you used to talk a lot about how nice the weather was. You know what I'm saying? You show people, you stunt for us, your little balcony or whatever. And that was real cute. You know what I'm saying? And I was kind of wondering how you feel right now. I know you said it's not quite as sunny, but I still get a feeling for why this is called the Golden State right now. You know, just clear skies, brisk 55 degrees. It's lovely weather. How are you experiencing the winter right now?
Like, I make a lot of money.
Okay, so you got your own heat. Is that what you're telling me?
That's kind of what it comes, that's kind of what it comes down to. Yeah. Like, I was just like, and in fact, I look back on those times and I'm actually very disappointed that y'all viewed it through the lens of me stunting on y'all as opposed to being happy for me and my good fortune. I just came up. What? You know what I'm saying? Like, it had just happened. And I just thought that y'all would be able to appreciate, like, hey, man, this is the setting that is producing the content that y'all are talking about. Like, this is where we got, right. You know what I'm saying? I'm not just the only one here. We all here. And so I knew when I got to New York that people was going to, like, try to throw it back at me. And I got that. And I understood that. And I recognized it. And it was fair. Yeah. And I encouraged all of them, when they wanted to do that, to go out to the 600-square-foot balcony on their beachfront condo and take a picture of the water in February and send it right back to me. Get me back. Okay. And you know what? That was the thing. The people that was the saltiest with me about that, they all still live in places with shitty weather. You know what I'm saying? And so they just wasn't in a position. Yeah. Now you was feeling like your little Northern California situation, which is kind of windy and chilly at times. You thought you was going to be able to throw that back over at me. But I will tell you this. Mm-hmm. There has not been much sun the last 2 weeks, and it has not been good for anybody. like let's be clear about this. It has been bad mood, Van Morrison, Astro Weeks weather here for far too long. It was grim. That kind of weather for Christmas. It was that kind of weather for New Year's. It's that kind of weather right now. And what makes it worse, so I messed around and got a spot. I don't know if this even matters, but it doesn't have central air because, you know, you lived in New York. You can't take that for granted. Maybe you got it, maybe you don't. It depends on a number of factors, right?
Absolutely.
But I got a lot of windows, so it's like bright, you know, that's cool, except it'll be 30 degrees outside, but that rare time the sun comes out, it makes it like 78 degrees in the crib, and you actually got to cut on the air conditioner.
Oh, you got that little sun, that little beam of sun coming right in.
Lot of sun. Like it'd be hot. This is a time in America, man. Like I feel like Omicron came through, and we realized, man, we done gave up, bro.
I mean, nothing works. Isn't that the thing? I think. See, you grew up kind of differently. I didn't have a lot of faith in people. But I had a lot of faith in systems. I was like,
yeah.
Surely there was no way that people would let society collapse, or that, you know, things would be so bad. You think that there are checks on bridges, you know, viral transmission, whatever. And you realize that, oh, those systems are also held up by people as well. So yeah. There's not the protections that you think from desolation and chaos that we believe that there are. But I know you grew up different. So that may not apply.
You know what, though? I did grow up with a bit of faith in like some of this stuff, right? And a lot of this stuff, in fact. And then like Katrina came around and I was like, oh, it shook my faith in systems, but it shook my faith in systems as a black person.
Right.
I didn't think they let all these white folks die.
Oh, that they would just, they don't care, right? Yeah, I'm just, yeah.
Like Katrina told me, damn, they'll still do it to us like they would. But it didn't dawn on me that under circumstances like this, that they'd look at white folks and be like, yeah, you on your own too. I thought they was looking out for them. Like, I think you and I talk about this, that something that gets lost is like, Dabo Swinney's a guy using an example of this, right? Like poor white people and the impossibility of explaining the idea of white privilege to them, because they just out here like, yo, I don't think you understand how we got it, you know, like, and ain't nobody even rallying for us or nothing like that. And it's true. It like totally makes sense, right? The average white person got it really rough.
Right.
It's not easy at all.
Life is misery for an overwhelming number of people in this country.
Yes.
And around the world, but in this country as well. Yes.
But I think for like, since most black people grow up around nothing but black people, right? Like that's what residential segregation is. And then the white people you then meet, if you do that, are like white people you've overcome to meet, a white person that's your boss or something like that. When in reality, it's a lot of white folks just out here struggling. And I learned here, they will send them all out there to die too. Now, don't get me wrong. A lot of those white folks are like, I would love nothing more than to die for this. But, you know, they still, like, whether they wanted to or not, they was going to be back out here. And America has told us, as soon as you can, get your ass back to work.
I mean, your mayor said that the other day, bro. You know what I'm saying? you know, Lieutenant Adams. I guess, again, you know, I understand that, like, New York is sort of an idiosyncratic place, you know, that... occasionally you get a character or whatever, but usually the mayor sort of made sense. The thing about Eric Adams, it doesn't make a lot of sense. I guess that maybe I don't understand enough like who his constituency is. I have an idea of it, but I guess I'm just a little confused as to how that dude, and I'm not even, this isn't even a political argument. Like just that cat being in charge of a city of 8 million people is sort of fascinating to me. I don't know how that happened.
He got the right relationships with money. And that I'm a former cop thing goes far. And it goes far with more, like.
A lot of black people like cops, man.
But that's what I was about to say. I think people misunderstand that most black people don't like cops who beat us, but are not averse to the concept and the idea. And he was the cop who bucked back against racism.
Right.
You know, so you put all that together and then he is good at talking to people with money. Right. And he is an entertaining person to listen to, which will get you very far in all this. But you talk about him, all of this is a staffing crisis. Like that is what, like you look at what's going on in the NFL and the way they decided to handle all this stuff in the face of Omicron, right? What they looked around and realized was we have a staffing crisis. The NBA, we can't get people to come to work. There are all these places that are like, oh, we ain't gonna lock down. Well, places are having to lock themselves down because they can't put enough people on the floor to do whatever the job is that needs to be done. Right. And they were like, okay, well, we got to change whatever the rules are.
Right. Yeah. I mean, well, see, I think that just comes down to the fundamental back, kind of tying it back to what we started with is, and not just that systems are the problem, but the fundamental cheapness of life. Like, I think I was just sort of surprised that people are just willing to accept mass death on this scale. Like that's kind of jarring to me that we've lost more people than, like, I guess twice the in-city population of Atlanta, like, you know, close to 900,000 people or 850,000 people. That's just an unfathomable amount of loss that we're willing to accept. And you, to your point, it's people like, you know what? You still got to get to school, still got to get to work. And that doesn't just seem to be a misunderstanding that, like, life can't go back to the way that we thought it was as long as there's this sort of belief that life is sort of cheap. You know what I mean? That we we're not going to be able to reconcile that as long as we're just willing to throw people into the meat grinder and be like, you know what, you guys figure it out, because we'll never get back to normal.
But the problem is people think their own lives are cheap too.
Yeah.
Like, as much as I want to fully chastise every institution for how I believe that they've handled this recklessly and incompetently at various mm-hmm. points, and like, ain't nobody took a harder blow than the CDC in terms of reputation, I would argue, in the last year and a half. But if you go look at the positivity rates for Omicron in New York, like, y'all don't really understand what this is. Did I send you that map?
No, I understand. You didn't send it to me. No.
Okay, okay. So, like, when things had gotten better, the positivity rate in New York would be around, like, 3%. You were getting down in the twos, you know? I went to the New York City map that broke it out by zip code. And given that the positivity rate, like, positivity rate in our zip code, for example, was, like, 3 at some point, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The scale, you know, because they color code it and it gets like from lighter red to darker red.
Mm-hmm.
The scale starts at like 15.
Oh, God.
Right. They're not even talking about you on the map.
Man.
If it ain't like at 15, the highs are in the like high 40s, like 47,
that's
48.
Unreal.
That's what I'm saying.
And that that has to be an undercount if it's that high. You know what I mean? Like, if it stands to reason to me that if it's like 40%, that it's actually something much higher than that.
Yes.
That's actually really terrifying. Although, again, I guess I'm still kind of, you know, reemerging into the world or whatever. But I kind of don't understand. Like, either it's more contagious, but less deadly, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it still affects unvaccinated people in a way that is, like, very troubling. So I guess, like, I'm still, that positivity rate sounds terrible. But I'm kind of like, okay, does that mean that I'm in danger? You know what I mean? Because I'm like, I'm boosted. I don't know, but I know you boosted too.
Yeah.
Like, what does that actually mean? You know?
I think we're still grappling with the definition of danger.
Right.
And by the way, check your phone. I just sent you that map. And so.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. You see what I'm saying?
That looks like a summer, you know, like a heat map in Australia in the summer or something.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So we got to have a broader societal discussion. Because different words mean different things in different places. And right. Culturally, we see a demonstration of this with food. And the word that I'm referring to is mild.
Oh, yeah.
Because the word that does a lot of work is mild. Now, when I read things about COVID, I hear the term mild. I hear the term severe.
Mm-hmm.
I never hear the term moderate. Right? I never hear about nothing in between. So, like, you basically hear about, I had the sniffles for a few days and they poking a hole in my chest, but nothing about the part in between. Right?
Right.
And so when I hear about mild or people talk about this, and I think about some of the things that people have told me, vaccinated people, you know, when they had the previous variants or whatever it is, I don't be hearing that stuff and necessarily thinking about it as being mild. Like, I know somebody that had a headache for 3.5 weeks.
Right.
I don't consider that to be mild. I can't imagine having a headache for 3.5 weeks. All right. Right? 3.5 weeks. Like, to me, that is not mild. People with the brain fog and carrying on, those things are not mild. So to me, it's still dangerous out here in these streets because I don't know how this thing is going to act once it crawl up in me, if it crawl up in me.
Well, you know, so I don't know if I had it. So, you know, remember right at the beginning of this last year, I had a lot of symptoms that added up to something that seemed like COVID, but I never tested positive for it. But for instance, I have what people call COVID toes. So your toes mm-hmm. just get red and swollen and itchy for, you know, I mean, for ostensibly no reason, but that is, you know, one of the symptoms. The one thing that really scares me and that people sort of overlook, because it happened to me briefly, like my taste got, you know, messed up mm-hmm. in the middle of that. I didn't totally lose my taste. I just lost my appetite. But the idea that you could lose your sense of smell or taste and you be like, oh, that's a mild symptom. Bro, that's neurological. You have no idea if that's coming back.
Like, I mean, it's the equivalent of going blind. It's in a way, or not the same thing. How about it's an analog of going blind, right?
Yeah.
Like, I have 5 senses and now I'm down one.
Right.
Think about this. If what it was causing deafness,
because
I can still get around and do stuff and all this stuff if I'm deaf, right? It's going to be a little harder. I got to figure some stuff out. But it would all just be panicking, right? It would be yes, I look at all that and I'm like, no, that is not mild. And I was just reading something the other day about how some people have reported that that loss of smell, right, losing their sense of smell or whatever, has an effect on their sex lives. Like a lot really? Of, you know,
oh, wait, hold
like,
on. I'm trying to,
I can't remember exactly how it goes, but basically all this sensory stuff goes together.
Wow.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, or like, you know, with like, there's one thing to be like, you lose your sense of taste, but there are other people reporting their sense of taste is now altered. And right. So it's not simply, I can't taste this. It's this thing that used to taste good, tastes awful. It's the thing that used to smell good, smells awful.
Right.
That ain't mild.
Right, exactly. That is a, like a severe change in your life. And I, the fact that people are willing to accept that is just sort of weird to me. I mean, you know, again, I'll never forget the moment when it occurred something was wrong with me. I was eating wings from Wingstop on the couch. And I remember I looked over at my wife and I was like, this don't taste like metal to you? You don't taste metal in this? And I was like, and this is, I mean, I enjoy wings. I had my pound of ranch. You know what I'm saying? And I was like, that's terrifying. You know, I mean, and I mean, your sense of taste is also supposed, it's not just to enjoy things. It's also meant to protect you as well.
Yes.
So the idea that that was compromised in some way and compromised for so long is actually sort of terrifying. And nobody can tell you exactly when it's going to come back if it is going to come back.
Right.
And I just like, that's just not a level of risk that I'm willing to accept. And as such, like a lot of people in my family think that I've become a little overboard. I'm one of the, you know, vax panickers or whatever.
Whatever,
but,
whatever, yeah, whatever. Yeah, call me a punk. That's cool. Hey, yeah. You know, I can handle that. Like yeah, that's good. That's good. Like all of this as it goes, and there's so much that's still mysterious. And again, like I think you and I have talked about this. I don't knock the leagues and all these people for trying to keep this thing rolling. Like, I don't think it's football that's getting people sick. I don't think it's basketball that's getting people sick. It is everything else that's going on here. And they're like, yo, if we got people that are willing to come out here and play some ball, then we got to get them out here to play some ball. But I will say this. When's the last time we had a good week of NFL football?
Man, see, I thought about this in advance way before this. And this is because I was just like, I think that we overestimate the amount of good football that is played in the NFL during yeah. any given week that's enjoyable to watch. And adding another week of it, I was like, if you guys want to see more backup quarterbacks, fine. But yes, to your point, every week, I remember for the last month or so, up until last week, I believe, people were like, oh, this is a bad slate right here. These are some bad games. And I'm like, well, bro, I mean, this is, you all want to see football so bad, and they have an incentive to keep showing it to you. But like, the football has not been great for a long time, but it's even more noticeable now that we're like, the rosters are really compromised.
The rosters are compromised. There's no great team in the league. Like, there's no team, even with adding games, there's no team right now in the AFC, I think, that has more than 12 wins. Like, it's just a lot. Like, it's a lot of hovering around in these spaces. Like,
well, I saw that the Patriots, and look, I've been busy the last few months. I saw that the Patriots were the top seed in the AFC at one point, like maybe a couple weeks ago.
Close.
And I was like, they're not good. I saw them play, and maybe I missed something, but I didn't remember to look at them.
I will say this, though. The last time I said that was 2001, and you know how that went. But that's how all of this looks right now. But obviously, you have to think that part of it is just everything that's going on, you know, in the world and with COVID and with the NBA. It's just hilarious, right? Like, somebody hit me with this, and I didn't realize it, but this is the truth. So Joe Johnson, you saw that he got signed.
I saw him score. Yeah, I saw him hoop. Yeah.
Do you know who made the decision to draft Joe Johnson?
Is it going to be Red Auerbach?
Yes.
Was it really?
Yes. Red Auerbach made the decision to draft Joe Johnson.
Oh, man. That would be a good time to say Joe Johnson played with Sam Jones or somebody like that. All right, rest in peace, Sam Jones. But yeah.
The 6 degrees of separation of Joe Johnson are going to take us back to Dr. Naismith.
I mean,
Fog Allen, you know what I'm saying?
That is shocking. Well, it's actually not that shocking. I mean, how old is Joe Johnson, like, in our age cohort, basically?
Joe Johnson was a freshman in college in 1999. And okay. So Patino had gotten fired in Boston. And one of the things Patino famously did was take away Red's title as president of basketball operations. Patino just had to be in charge of everything. He couldn't even, like, let Red have it. So then Patino got out of there, and that left Red to be in charge, and Red made the decision to draft Joe Johnson.
I mean, another great choice. I mean, because
it was a great call.
Joe was a lottery pick, but a low lottery pick, if I'm mistaken. Yeah.
Yes, because he was at that time where not, like, it wasn't like now, where everybody's a child, you know, in the draft. There was still a couple of...
He played in college for, like, a couple years or something
He played
like that.
2 years. So, yeah.
He played 2 years. So, yeah. Yeah. Man, that's when Arkansas used to be cold. At the tail end of when Arkansas, again, kids, you won't understand, Arkansas used to be cold. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
It was that was an athletic program to be reckoned with. You may not remember it. You may never see it again, but trust us, it happened.
I can't even remember who Joe Johnson's coach was, because I think Nolan recruited him, and then they ran Nolan out. And then the year after that, Joe Johnson went on about his business. But Joe Johnson born in 1981. To answer your question.
That's Gen X? No. That's a millennial.
That's elder millennial.
Putting elder millennial.
But here's the thing about it. That's elder millennial, but Joe Johnson from Little Rock. And I don't feel like Little Rock produced any millennials. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like in 2001 or whatever year it was. Like, in 1981. Was it 1981 in Little Rock?
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people, again, this is aging us. Because I had to go to Little Rock twice a year growing up as a kid. My family, as we know, is from Arkansas, all up in there. I had to go to Arkansas. So right around the early 90s, me and my cousin would go to the mall. I think it was the University Park Mall, something like that. And this is during the Bangin' in Little Rock era. Okay? Yes. And Joe Johnson grew up in the heart of that. And, I mean, I encourage you. It really is a time capsule. Because, first of all, this is like the I know that they've been documentaries, obviously, since, you know, they've been able to do film or whatever, but it just is a very bare bones documentarian effort. And you see some things in Bangin' in Little Rock that are hilarious and terrifying. And that's what Joe Johnson, that's the era he grew up in Little Rock.
Yeah, if you watch Snowfall, there's a reason why they sent them on the road trip to Little Rock. Like, that was a thing. That was how the rock and everything was getting to the other parts of the country. Was, you know, people figured it out. They had Kent Folk that was back at the crib in Arkansas. But yeah, that's Joe Johnson.
What was interesting, I would, because you know that you know how the Great Migration works. There are a lot of people from Arkansas that went to California, right?
Yes.
Like, Arkansas lost a lot of people in the midst of the Great Migration, and a lot of those people went to California, LA in particular, and then they came back. And when they came back, they brought some of the things they learned in California to Arkansas, you know?
Yes. Yeah, because in the end, they got to LA and they realized, for us, it's like Arkansas with palm trees.
Yeah.
And it costs a lot more money, right? And then eventually they're like, all right, they ain't really stringing us up no more. You know what I'm saying? We'll take it back to the crib. And I mean, that's like the same thing like with the Mississippi-Chicago pipeline. And then next thing you know, Mississippi got GDs.
Right.
Next thing you know, because some people was like, "Nah, we gonna go back."
Right.
Like, yeah, let's
go home. I can find my own friends at home. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And this takes us to you just wrapped up. Congratulations, season 6 of Slow Burn on Slate. I highly recommend that you check it out on LA Riots. I checked out every episode, and like for me,
thank you, my brother,
having listened to you do the one on Biggie and Tupac, and seeing the growth from that one as you figured out how you wanted to do it in this one, which told a great story by laying out very individual pieces, largely by chronology, but still it was like very distinct chapters of all the different people that were affected by everything that had gone on. It was a dope ride, and so I highly recommend everybody check it out. If for no other reason, then there is nothing better than listening to, I guess we got people around, so I have to say a little different, Los Angeles Afro-Americans speaking in their very particular dialect.
Are you talking about my boy Kiki? You talking about Kiki Watson?
Is Kiki my man that dropped the line when explaining his participation in the riots? I ain't even really want to go out there, man. Like, that ain't really my thing, right? But you know, you imagine somebody come up to you and be like, yo, you know, I got tickets to a Garth Brooks concert. And I'm like, yo, I don't do Garth Brooks. Like, yo, man, come on, man, it's free. I'm like, all right, I'll go. The next thing you know, you got me in there and I'm do-si-do-ing and yee-haw with the rest of you. what a comparison.
Man. I know, man. As soon as he said it, we're like, oh, that is gold. I mean, look.
With a straight face, by the way. I don't think he understood how funny it was.
It's not a joke to him, you know? and look, I have to, the caveat I have to give that is necessary is that what I think he did was horrible, right? That we both think that it was like horrendous. I think the idea that he's not quite as apologetic as people would like to be sort of funny, because that has become more of a thing in American culture, like a total lack of shame or whatever. Mm-hmm. And like, you do something terrible and whatever, you got to deal with it. That's just who I am. And Kiki Watson is sort of, he is apologetic for what happened, but he's not apologetic for why it happened. And I think that a lot of people have have difficulty reconciling those two things. And so, yeah, so he says things that are sort of funny about something that is really awful that he was a part of. And it affected his life. I mean, it's not like he paid a price. He paid a price in a way, in a lot of ways, that those cops never paid for beating Rodney King.
You can understand the emotion and how the emotion led to something that a whole lot of people should not have done, is the best way to put it. And the thing about it is, one, I think this society gets too charged up about property crime. Like, I just think that we have a disproportionate concern for property crime versus a whole other realm of ills. Like, when people talk about how horrifying it is when these dudes are running up 20 deep in a Louis store now and, like, grabbing everything. And I don't see anything horrible about that.
It doesn't even seem scary, right?
Right. Like, these cats recognize ain't nobody here gonna shoot us, right? Like, I ain't heard nothing about them. They just running in and taking the stuff. I don't hear anything horrible about that. But the property crime element with 1992 in Los Angeles is, who were the people that were being harmed and how did that affect them in a way that Louis is never going to be affected,
right?
You know, by trying to rebuild their stuff and everything else. Like, that's not going to happen there. Like, that's the part that is, like, not so great about what went down. And then, of course, you know, the white people who just wound up in the wrong places at the wrong time.
Yeah. I mean, your heart kind of goes out to him. I would like to know what Reginald Denny thinks about this all these years later, or Larry Tarvin, another one of the truck drivers that was beat up in Florence and Normandy. And we tried to reach out to them. They didn't get back with us. You know, I mean, they caught a really bad break that they should not have had to take. And again, you can put that on the LAPD. I mean, at a time when they should have been there, right? They should have. We needed them in the community to prevent something from getting out of control, and they actually weren't there. And it was just that's sort of the irony of the thing. So
let me ask this question, because I think it's like, intellectually and on its face, it's a totally fair point. What exactly was LAPD going to do other than shoot a bunch of people?
Well, so that's a great question. And so I think back to the moments before the Reginald Denny beating gets started, and they're arresting a young man named Sean Don Daniels about a block over. And that's where a lot of things just started. That's where the tension in the neighborhood started to build. Like, there's this, they're arresting this 16-year-old kid. They've twisted him up. He's hurting. He says he can't breathe, and people are getting upset. And the reason they backed out is because they said, you know what? We think if we used any force, it would escalate things. So to your point, you're right. Like, there's totally a world in which LAPD overreacts, and that it is a literal bloodbath, that it really gets out of control. But totally abandoning the area and not coming back with reinforcements, I don't blame them for backing down in the moment, for not escalating things and not antagonizing people that were already upset. But for totally abandoning the area and allow chaos and anarchy to reign, I think there's something wrong with that. And I mean, if we're going to have law enforcement, if you're going to have it, you need to have
right.
it then. Right.
Right. And by the way, lining up along I-10 to make sure everybody knew. Y'all got it over here. We ain't really tripping right. on that. But the second you tried to come over here.
It's funny because, well, not funny. It's tragic. The heat map of damage in L.A., like, you could just see, it's all concentrated on the southern side of town. But you can't, you know, yeah, like, what, that I-10? Nah, ain't nothing no going on over there on that west side of L.A., or the western L.A. County. And really, barely anything above the Mulholland Drive area. Because, I mean, there were a couple of incidents up in San Fernando Valley and all that sort of stuff, but mostly it was all concentrated in this very small area, not small, but small for LA area, of black and brown neighborhoods that were just totally, you know, immolated.
Yeah, and if you want to do this, I'd love to see somebody talk about some of, like, the offshoot disturbances that took place in other cities.
Yeah.
And yeah. Some of that was obviously, we so sick and tired of this, but also, like, when I got to college, they were telling us about the folks at Clark, because, yeah, that's like 5 years after when I got to college. Yeah. And, you know, college students, few of them got a little charged up watching the news. Decide they gonna go out here. Like, the dude, there was a Korean dude that owned a store across from the gym, and he was out there like, yo, what is the problem?
You're
we've
right.
never had any problems down here, right? Like right. The Black-Asian relationship is very particular, you know, in Los Angeles, in a way that didn't apply everywhere else. And so they said this one dude, he was in the honors program, they told me, and they caught him, and he had a brick in his bag, and he was trying to explain, if he wasn't out here causing a ruckus, why he had a brick. I was like, should just said, I'll never leave the house without my lucky brick.
I mean, what? He had a brick. I mean, Come on, bro. Yeah. Austin, where do you get a brick from?
I wondered that part. Like, did you go to Home Depot and just get one brick? Because I feel like if you go to the store and get one brick, you should have to present ID.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like, oh, we should be able to put you on some sort of, like, file. You know what I mean? Yes. You need to go on some sort of a warning list.
Yes. But this hit me, though. This was, I think, a very interesting thing about the season that, again, I really recommend people check out. But the discussion of the relationship between blacks and Asians in Los Angeles. And what I thought was the most interesting thing that I hadn't thought about was you talked about Asian businesses and the black, you know, group of black folks getting together to try to, you know, smooth this out and figure out how to make things better, because you had all these Asian folks who own stores in black communities, and they said the discussions would go good and they figure it out. And then they started talking about black people opening stores in Asian communities, and everything stopped. And what hit me when I heard that was, you know, I had never thought about even the very idea of, well, let us set up some stores over where y'all at. I never thought about that before. I mean, like, that tells you a whole lot about what the power dynamics of all this stuff is, and our expectation that people are going to come into black neighborhoods and make money. But never would they allow the reverse.
Right. Yeah. And you're referring to Danny Bakewell, who's longtime organizer, activist in L.A. I mean, some people used to refer to him as the Al Sharpton of L.A. But yeah, and he's the guy.
If you saw the O.J. Made in America documentary, for those of you who don't know very much about black people, he was the black dude and you didn't know that black people look like that. Very Louisiana.
It would explain that he's from New Orleans, right?
Yep, I was going to say, very Louisiana.
Right. So, yeah, so it we could confuse him, but once you hear him talk, you'll understand it. But, yeah, so, you know, they did try to set up a Black Korean Alliance in the mid-'80s after a rash of robberies on Korean stores in black neighborhoods. And Danny Bakewell is the activist who's like, no, why should we help you help them make money in our communities? Why don't you help us make some money in their communities? And, look, there are a lot of reasons, you know, a lot of them dealing with racism, why black people didn't get the sort of capital to open their own businesses, even in their own neighborhoods, right? But so I think that's like, that was that tension. It was like, well, Koreans are saying, we didn't have anything to do with this. Like, we're here, we're poor, we're trying to better ourselves. Like, the professions that we were able to have back in our old country, we can't do here because of racism. And so we have to go into business for ourselves. And we can't help that, you know, we had money or got helps or got loans that enabled us to open businesses. And black people are sitting there looking at it, but wait a minute, we've been here this whole time. We never get to have a stake in our own community. And so that's just, I mean, you can just see how the alliances were always going to have difficulties going forward. I mean, for understandable reasons. Like, it's not like I don't think anybody was necessarily wrong. The conflict just seemed unavoidable in a country that sort of pits people against each other for a diminishing amount of resources.
Yeah, and then you get to the end after the ride. Like, a lot of interesting stuff about Tom Bradley, but you also get to the end, and I think, obviously, for people, the most disheartening thing. And Miami had something very similar after the McDuffie riots of 1980, where you could ride through Miami and see stuff that was burned down during the McDuffie riots, and it looks exactly like it did in 1980. And the fact that Tom Bradley, when he got in touch with Peter Ueberroth, and Peter Ueberroth had run the Olympic bid, and they, you know, got that money to get the Olympics off in 1984, and he called him back like, yo, let's get this stuff rebuilt after the riots. And Peter Ueberroth was like, yo, I tried, man, but they ain't giving me no money for this.
Right. I mean, and he was working against a couple of factors. I mean, one, there was a crippling recession going on in the country. So the corporations that he had turned to in 84 didn't even have the money or the jobs in 92 to pull off what they had tried then, especially the sort of long-term commitment you need to rebuild an area as opposed to hosting a 2-3 week event like the Summer Olympics. Like, it's a totally different sort of chore that they were sort of poorly equipped for. And then, yeah, I mean, you kind of saw it after the so-called racial reckoning of last year, right? Companies make a lot of promises, say what they're gonna do while the heat is on them, and people have a lot of attention, and then, you know, a couple months later, like, man, we ain't cutting in that check for real. They ain't doing that. And so that's why you just need a robust government. Like, that's the thing. Like, I mean, I know that a lot of people think government should be run by business, and I'm not trying to, like, make a real political argument here, but you need a robust government. You need systems in place to guide that sort of development, because people are not going to do it on just out of altruism or out of the goodness of their hearts. Like, they want to return, and they have some assumptions about those communities that they either won't be able to make the sort of returns they want, or they just don't want to deal in those places. And so you need government to guide that sort of development. And Tom Bradley, in his sort of his final act, you know, he had always depended on private industry and businesses to do things that government should have been doing. And for that final act, he tried it again and it did not work.
Yeah, man. But again, Slow Burn season 6, check that out.
And Bomani got me through it, by the way. Y'all don't know, man. I was stressing, man. Your boy reached out to me, man, because I was stressing, you know, and because I was like, man, I don't know if I'm going to make it. I don't know if I'm gonna make it. Your boy checked in on me and helped me to get through it. So, man, I appreciate that and the support of the podcast.
Dog,
obviously.
No, absolutely no problem at all, man. You like might don't make it. I'm like, nah, it's gonna get done. Don't get me wrong. Like that's the thing you need to understand. Hook, crook, it'll get done.
Yeah, the thing is like you just like I hope it's good. You know what I'm saying? When it's done, you just like, but sometimes you can't even worry about that. I just need something on the paper, something on the screen.
Yes.
So
yes, best dissertation is one that's finished. I tell you, the best advice I ever saw, and you are on a little bit of a time crunch, but I forget who it was. I saw this a few months ago talking about writing. He's like, even if you ain't got nothing to write, write it down. Right? We can fix what's on the page.
Right.
We can't fix nothing. You know?
It's so true. Don't let perfect be the enemy of good. And that was always that's always been my thing. Like it's got to be lined up right. The punctuation, all this stuff, even the font has to look right. And sometimes you just got to get it done. That's what I have.
You killed it, dog. Like, real talk, though. That's the thing, man. You killed this.
Appreciate you, bro, for real.
I would take you to our other topic of discussion that we have here, you and I, a lot of on college football.
Yes, sir.
So I'm not one of these SEC. I mean, I believe I'm an SEC exceptionalist because it is the best conference in college football.
Yeah.
But it is not a completely different world of college football than everybody else. Keep in mind, it's got 14 teams.
Right. I mean, Missouri is in the league, okay?
Arkansas is in the league. Vanderbilt's in the league, you know. And so after the playoff, Georgia blew Michigan's doors off. Alabama, I ain't even bother watching that, right? But they did what they did to Cincinnati. And people are like, this is just proof that the SEC is totally different. I'm like, no, it's not, because this is exactly the same thing that they was doing to the SEC.
Alabama and Georgia do that to everybody in the league.
What has happened is three. Ohio State lost a couple games this year, but three programs have separated themselves from everybody else in terms of recruiting and resources and application of all of this. And then everybody else is below them. But it's not just totally about the SEC. We knew all year that Georgia and Alabama were better than everybody else. Like, what this was this year is, what if USC and Texas had to play semifinals games? And they would have smacked whoever they played against in those semifinals the same way that Georgia and Alabama smacked these boys they put in front of them.
Right. I think the thing is, we knew that Alabama was good, but when they lost to A&M, people got a little confused. You know, they had that sort of inexplicable stumble. But yeah, other than that, we've always known that they were one of two of the three best programs in the country this year. Like, I think the thing, we came around on Cincinnati, and I'm a person that believes, you know what? Let's get a group of five team a chance. You know what I'm saying? I believe that, like, to keep the sport interesting, and if we're going to put all this money and attention into the game and you want to keep people interested, eventually you do have to open up opportunity at some point. So I can understand the Cincinnati thing, sort of understand the Notre Dame thing. But let's get real. We always knew it was Alabama and Georgia in the SEC, and they were going to be there at the end. And that's ultimately what we get. I mean, people try to say that recruiting doesn't matter and it's overrated, the recruiting rankings and all that stuff, and people don't know. But like, those things really actually predict pretty closely who's going to be your national champion in 3 or 4 years. And Alabama and Georgia, currently, the level of talent on their rosters is far and above, I'm not going to say empirically, but like according to the recruiting rankings or whatever over the last few years, their talent is so far above everybody else. Nobody else is on that plane. That's not the SEC's thing.
You and I talked about this. In 2018, Rivals had Georgia with a recruiting class with 8 five stars. For those of you who don't really, like, you hear the term five star, to put it in perspective, you got to understand, it's like 35 stars per year. Like, that's about how many five stars are going to be in a class, right? And Georgia had 8 of them, and those aren't even the dudes on this team that are good.
Right, right.
Right? Like, it's not just they're getting all the five stars in the world, it's they're getting all the high-level four stars, and they're finding guys and developing them. Because, look, it's a tough evaluation thing. Like, when people say recruiting rankings don't matter, a better way to put it is that it is inexact, right? It doesn't fully matter for the individual player. It absolutely matters in the aggregate. You want to get as many players that there's a consensus on that these guys are really good.
Right,
and they get them.
The vast majority of recruits or whatever are 3 stars or lower, you know, and then that's on development and who you get in target. Exactly. But it's undeniable that if you have more 5 stars than anybody else, it's going to work out for you one way or another.
Right.
You're going to have to deal with something, my brother. Have you been paying attention to that school up the street from where you grew up? And the they have 6 5-stars in their class and have the highest rated recruiting class in recruiting rankings history?
You talking about Texas A&M?
Are you prepared to deal with what's coming?
You don't ever have to be prepared to deal with A&M getting
this
all
is
those
different.
Players.
This yeah, is no, different.
No, this is all I'm saying. And I know some things have changed, don't get me wrong. But whenever that happens at Texas A&M, Joel, what happens next?
That world doesn't exist. That's the problem. Does that world exist anymore?
I'm just saying this one more time. Anymore? I just want to say this again. Whenever this kind of thing happens at Texas A&M, what happens next?
You can give a Trans Am through NIL deals now.
Okay,
probably.
I'm just saying. The NCAA has always shown up, and if that's not going to be the case in this one, something's going to happen, right? That's all I'm telling you.
People got to pray that that happens.
You know, because now that I don't be engaging with Texas football, like I'm just kidding.
Okay.
Nah, man. Yeah, I just can't. Okay. Come on, man.
You don't want to do the choo-choo thing, bro?
Talked about this, man. They out here embarrassing me. And I just can't. I can't put my name
on
that no more.
They've been embarrassing you for a long time. You just finally. You finally catching on now. But they've been embarrassing you for a long time.
I know. I mean, it's not like the guy who told me that I was never going to be an NFL player was later found to use
that?
The N-word around his players.
He was right.
He was right about using the N-word around his players? Is that what you just said?
Nah. His talent evaluation was correct. And he nudged me to a career that allowed me to do slow burn 6. But, I mean, look, he said the N-word. That's fine. But, you know, I mean, I don't agree with that.
Yeah.
That's obviously terrible. He apologized for it. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. It ain't like, you know, something racist happened and they're like, you know what, we're going to do it anyway. And you're going to have to deal with it. Because that would be horrible if you had to do something like that.
Like I keep saying, I don't really do that over there, but I'm going to find A&M to be ridiculous for the rest of my life. Like, there's no way that is ever going to change. None whatsoever.
You saying, I mean, I grew up with A&M the same way that you did. And I've grown, you know, the Aggie jokes, they have some kernel of truth in them.
People
I don't even know about that.
The people don't even know about the Aggie jokes.
They don't know about Aggie jokes. I guess they probably don't. You got to really be, you know, like Texan and of
a certain
age.
The problem with the Aggie jokes is the Aggie jokes sound like another line of jokes using a term that I don't like. Let's say jokes people would make about Polish folks.
Yes. Oh, man, Polish jokes. You remember? Well, I feel like that's a big staple of night court or something like that.
Yeah, but like, you know, they use another term that I actually think is like you're not allowed to use.
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay. All right.
Yeah. So I was like, Polish jokes. Yes, but Aggie jokes and those Polish jokes are very, very similar.
Very similar. Very similar. People don't, yeah. I guess people, man, I just, we're really.
They're weird, Joel. They as people are weird and they know it and everything about that. Like, I'm so amazed that they can get anybody through an official visit and be like, yeah, 4 years of this.
But man, bro, go to Kyle Field. I mean, hey, look, it all sounds crazy until you go and spend a Saturday in Kyle Field. And I've done it a couple times, and it is kind of surreal. I mean, that's just, it is weird, but there's not another environment like that in college football. I'm not saying it's the best. I'm not saying, you know, it's better than Death Valley and LSU on a Saturday night. But what I am saying is that a game at Kyle Field is like a particular experience, and I could understand being a recruit going in there and being like, whoa.
And imagine if they had ever been good. Like, they got a lot of passion for a football program that has provided them very little.
Are you going to disrespect Kyler Murray's daddy like this? Are you going to disrespect Darren Lewis like this? I think it's Darren Lewis still alive.
Yeah, it was Darren Lewis. It was Darren Lewis.
Yeah.
And what happened right
Greg
after
Hill.
Them? Yeah, I mean, they had some players. I'm just looking at it right now. They ain't won a conference title since my sophomore year of college.
My dude, well, shout out to Jason Webster and Cornelius Anthony, two Mo City legends that were on that team.
Oh, okay. Yeah, Mo City out here sending people into that. Okay. They ain't won a conference championship since 1998. Like, as much as we got jokes about Texas and their underachieving and what they should be, they still been a hell of a lot more than Texas A&M for the entirety of the history of that program and even the post-integration portion, which is where Texas falls off.
I mean, look, the thing is that you can say all that. That's true. But that doesn't excuse the problems. I mean, you all have out. The thing is like,
it doesn't.
You can say that A&M has underachieved.
Hold on.
You can say that A&M has underachieved.
Stop now. And this is why I'm going to tell you to stop now. Because you're right. It doesn't excuse. But that wasn't what we was talking about. You wanted to talk about Texas A&M and then just try to shoehorn that into an excuse.
Well, you're talking about the past and I'm talking about the future, my brother.
I'm trying to make a point about
Harold Perkins and other cats going over here.
And I'm saying this ain't the first time that I've heard this. I need to actually look up this Harold Perkins because I went to high school with a Harold Perkins and I wonder if they can.
Well, you know he's from the South Fair something area.
That's why I'm trying to figure it out. Yeah, that's why I'm trying to figure out if he's head son, because I mean, it's not even no thing. Like, anybody would. He had a big hit. He had a big hit.
Okay,
like,
all right, okay.
Like we called him. Like, we called him Head to his face. Like, it's not like this is some like secret nickname. Like, his brothers are famous track coaches. But I saw that and I was wondering, like, is that Head, son?
That sounds. I mean, I judging from what I know of the kid and what I saw on his huddle tape, if you talk about he was fast and was a good athlete. You know, I didn't see his side of his head. I don't know.
Yeah, no. All them boys ran track, and Head ran track.
Was he any good?
Yeah, he was good. Yeah, he was good. Okay. But I really looked at it, and I was just like, is that his son? Like, because his name is Harold Perkins.
Oh, man. I mean, it's a small world.
If Harold Perkins' middle name is Allen, then that's him.
Well, I would tell you this. I mean, how many Harold Perkinses you think they're making in this generation of people? That's not a name.
But again, you know he was a Harold Perkins Jr., and so, you know, that's what's keeping a lot of these names alive.
Right. Well, that's what I'm saying. But, like, how many other Harold Perkinses do you think are made other than the original? So it's got to be that one. Do you think somebody else normal? I'm not normal, I shouldn't say.
Well,
that.
Actually, here's why I say it won't be.
Well, in 2002, do you think they saved a baby Harold Perkins?
Well, hold on. Here's what I'm saying. He's not listed as Harold Perkins Jr., and I feel like in this day and age, they are obligated to call themselves juniors. Oh.
Well, shout out to Head, though. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. He got his props. And if your son is going to A&M, the impending new Texas football power, then shout out to you, you know?
Then, I don't even know why. I mean, what'd that do for TCU? Like, you going out of your way to try to antagonize me right now.
Oh, no, but gave a little shout out. Don't do that, because, you know, I grew up and I sort of had a thing for A&M because I thought A&M was much. We talked about this before.
Yes.
I thought A&M was blacker than it was. My uncle went there. They had Kevin Murray, Kyler Murray's daddy, as a quarterback, a black quarterback at Texas A&M in the 1980s, okay? So that was just something that you did not see, okay? Jackie Sherrill wasn't really an A&M sort of coach in that way. So that was a lot for a young Joel Anderson to get a little confused about. They didn't take presence over University of Houston, but they had a little swag.
Yeah, well, I mean, after they stopped putting University of Houston on TV, I could understand like why you could be like, I need to go find a team I could actually watch. That's not even shade.
Why you taking shots at him, bro? I
said, no, you know, not even shame, but I'm just saying. Okay. Man won a Heisman Trophy and nobody saw it.
I mean, you look, man. I mean, that's how dirty Andre Weir did y'all. He was so good, they didn't even have to see him. I mean, that's how crazy football was. I mean, somebody put up like what would be regular, like a really good college season of numbers now. They wouldn't be spectacular, but just a really good season. Nobody saw it, and it was still good enough to win the Heisman.
A staggering indictment of everybody else in his class.
I mean, like, Genio Toretta won 1 year around that time, too. So,
fair.
I mean,
fair. But hey, man, that's Joel Anderson, Slow Burn Season 6. Check that out. Check him out at Slade.com, but don't check him out until like next month because Joel ain't doing no work.
Leave me alone. I don't want nobody to bother me. I'm off.
Tell you, get on Southside today, man.
All right, man. I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it. I got a lot to catch up on. I promise. I'm going to get up on it. All right. Appreciate you having me on, bro.
Yeah, man. And ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this 3 times a week. Gabe Bassain and Adi Khan handling things behind the scenes. Thank you, gentlemen. Remember, follow The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater, and we'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or follow on the ESPN app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.